him and Little?
Well, in the electrical engineering department, during a period of, say, 5 or 6 years after 1921.
Sure.
Somewhere in through there.
Talk about the whole 20s, if you'd like.
Yes. We brought in a man by the name of Higgins. And about that time, during that period too, the local people got interested in trying to sell Gainesville to the rest of the world. And so they went to the legislature and they prevailed upon the legislature to make available, I think it was $50,000, to build a powerful radio station so that they could sell Gainesville to New York and Atlanta and to Boston and what have you. And they established, the bill really established that station under the College of Engineering. So Dr. Benton called me in and asked me if I would take over the radio station, the design of the radio station. Well, I told him, no, I don't think I would want to do that because there was a field that was out of my bailiwick, and that I was basically a power man. Things changed later though. And I said, I don't think that you could possibly have a radio station in Gainesville to do what the people in Gainesville wanted to do. You can, in the daytime, if you can get out 40 miles, you'd be lucky. At nighttime, you might occasionally get them up further, but it would not satisfy them. So I don't think we ought to do it. So anyway, Dr. Benton then decided that he would not, that we would kind of not do anything about it. And the excuse he gave was that $50,000 was not enough. Well, under the next legislature, Addison Pound and some of his colleagues went up to Tallahassee and got the legislature to increase it by a substantial amount. I don't remember the exact figure, but it was a much larger figure. And again, Dr. Benton came to me and said the same story, and I told him again, no, that was not what I wanted to do. So we looked around and we got another man by the name of Higgins. And we made Higgins the engineer in charge of the radio station. And as a result, why the station was built, and then there were continuous quarrels between the engineer and the contractors and Dr. Benton. And I was awfully glad I was on the outside looking in. So finally, one of the contractors in town put in a bill for some work, and Higgins approved the bill, as I recall it, and the controller of the Tallahassee State, Benton had disapproved the bill. He approved it over Benton's head. And anyway, there was quite a squabble, and I don't recall exactly the details, but it ended up that there was a hearing by the Board of Control with reference to Dr. Benton's participation in this particular thing, pointing out that he too was had an interest, a financial interest in the contracting firm. Well, it worried Dr. Benton so much that I think it was one of the things that helped cause his death later on. But I believe, and I honestly believe, that Dr. Benton was one man who was impeccably honest, that there was no question in any way that he had done anything improper or wrong, and it was just a nasty deal all the way through. Well, the radio station was built, and here it was under the guise of the College of Engineering. Now, Dr. Benton died a few years later, and Dr. Tigard became president.
This was 1928.
Well, when there was quite a furor about the, although the law said that the engineering college was supposed to be in charge of the station, the programming was something which the engineers were not competent at all to do. And so Dr. Benton talked to me about it. I said, maybe I shouldn't wish this on my friend Riley, but Riley's always interested in making contacts and so forth. This is a wonderful opportunity. Turn the programming over to Riley. Let him have charge of it.
Bert Riley.
Let him have charge. He was head of the General Extension Division too. I said, let him take care of the programming. I said, I think he'll welcome it. He'll buy the hook, line, and sinker, and we'll take care of the we'll take care of the engineering. So that's the way it went. So Riley took it over. Well, they began having troubles, and it got so that the engineering staff had to get permission from the announcing staff if they wanted to talk to go into the other place, or that the announcers wanted to go to the engineering, to the operating room, they had to get permission. And there was a lot of friction between the two groups. And so when Dr. Benton died and Tigard was now the president, Tigard called me over and he said, now we're having problems over at the radio station, and Dr. Benton's no longer here. I want you to take care of the radio station. I said, now wait a minute. I said, that was the one provision I made with Dr. Benton, and I wouldn't do that. That's not my field. He said, well, we have so much trouble down there and all like that. There's so much friction and so forth. Have you any suggestions? I said, yes, I'll give you a suggestion. I said, appoint a committee of about 20 people from different parts of the campus and put the radio station in charge of this committee. He says, that'll never work. He says, how can you have a committee of 20 people taking charge of a station? I said, you can't. He said, but you can appoint a chairman of the committee and then let the chairman do that. Well, who do we appoint a chairman? I said, Garland Powell. See, like the president had brought down Powell, who had no educational experience. He did have political experience, and he didn't know what to do with him. Now he had a job. So that's where Garland Powell became director of the station.
WRUF. Now, Garland Powell then became the director of WRUF.
That's right.
And it was located in the little building across street, right across street from the museum, which is now the police station on the campus.
That's right.
Was that the original site of the first and only site?
Yeah, it was called WDBH, I think, or something like that.
To begin with, yeah. And then WRUF.
Yeah.
And Red Barber was one of the first announcers.
And it's rather interesting that when Red Barber graduated and he wanted to go to WLW to see if he could get a job there.
Cincinnati.
And we were going to Pittsburgh. And so we rode up, we told Red, we'd take him along. So we got in the car, we rode.
This is you and Ann.
And yeah, and Marvin was then born. So as we got into Georgia, and Red was doing some driving, we got into the foothills, and I told Red, I said, now Red, we're soon gonna come to some hilly country, some mountain country, and you're gonna put your foot on the gas, and you're gonna find it's hardly moving. And you won't realize what the trouble is, but you'll be going up a high grade, and it's just pulling hard. So we got on a little further, and he turns around and said, Prof, aren't they the biggest hunks of dirt you ever saw in your life? I said, you haven't seen anything yet. There'll be some bigger hunks of dirt coming along. So sure enough, we got a little further along, and Red had his foot down for the floorboards. He said, I know what you told me before. He said, but there's something wrong. I got my foot all the way down, and the car's going 12 miles an hour. So that was Red's initiation, the first time, I think, out of the state. And then we went to Pittsburgh to stay with Ann's people. Red was with us, and that night he had to go to WLW. And he was debating with himself. Should he go on a day coach, sleep, have trouble sleeping, or should he spend the difference and take the Pullman so he might be able to get a night's rest over before he gets to the interview the next morning? But he just hesitated to spend the money. But I think he decided that he would take the day coach and go up that way. I'm not sure whether he did or not. I will say this about Red. If every man tried hard, working for success, Red was it. He studied when he went out for a broadcast, before the broadcast, days before, he would get a lot of information on all the players and everything else. And he never went cold on a scene. He worked hard to do a good job.
Did you continue over the years your role as a mechanical advisor to the radio station?
Well, shortly after Dr. Batten died, and Banks Duncan became the chief operator. Banks Duncan was a very competent operator.
And, radio operator.
Yes. And I got so that I could depend entirely on Banks. Banks did the engineering, Banks did the operation. When I took over, one of the first things I did as engineer, though, was that at that time, they did not have what is known as crystal control or piezoelectric control of the frequency, so that you could, you wouldn't have to adjust dials to keep yourself on frequency. If the frequency was automatically controlled by a piezoelectric oscillator. And at that time, we had 50% modulation. And we were one of the first stations that rebuilt the equipment so as to get 100% operation and piezoelectric control, which made us as far as the FCC was concerned, gave them the feeling that we were a quality station. And I thought that was a good step forward. I nominally was the engineer, but Duncan should get credit for the work that came after that, because I had other things to do and he did that very well.
I want to ask you, continue on this line of personalities, because we need your interpretation. Talk to me a little bit about Dr. Farr, and also about the Farr family.
I don't know very much about them, except my contacts were casual with them. They lived across the street from us. I would see them when they were friendly, and I was friendly with them and everything else. I heard lots of rumors, but they meant nothing to me, and I would not want to play with rumors.
So you were not a socially intimate with the Farr family?
No.
How about Dean Anderson?
We were very close to Dean Anderson. We moved from the apartments in the early 20s to a rented house on Magnolia Street, that I don't know what that would be now. But the Anderson family lived across street. And when Marvin was a baby, Mrs. Anderson was like a mother to Ann in handling the problems that arose with the birth of Marvin and as he grew up. And our relations were extremely friendly, and Dr. Anderson himself was a real scholar. He was a fine person, and I think he was a good disciplinarian.
What about Dr. Crow?
I knew Dr. Crow. I'm not too much socially, but he I don't recall any incidents at the moment that I could embellish the story.
He was the secretary of the faculty, I believe the records show. Did this mean that the faculty met as a whole university faculty from time to time?
I can't say for sure, but I think that when we had a faculty meeting, it included everybody from the rank of instructor up.
Did you meet in Peabody Hall on the second floor in that auditorium?
We did.
And the president of the university?
Was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember Enwall getting up one time, and a question came up, should we wear our caps and gowns at commencement? And there was quite a feeling upon the parts of the men that this was outdated now. You didn't have to wear caps and gowns. And I remember Enwall getting up and making a very oratorical address in which he emphasized, why should you be ashamed to wear the regalia of your profession? Do you ever see a military man object to wearing his uniform? And my office in Benton Hall was right across the street from where Enwall would hold his classes in Peabody Hall. And I once told Enwall, I said, you know, I tell you right now, I enjoy attending your classes. He says, what do you mean? He said, I never see it. I said, you don't have to, I just open the window a little bit. He had the loudest voice any man on the campus.
When did Blake Van Leer come to the campus?
Well, when Benton died, and then Reed was made acting dean. And he was acting dean for about 2 years, I guess, a couple of years, maybe less. And then Van Leer was given the job. And we became pretty good personal friends. And in fact, I really, although I didn't have the title, I was really acting most of the time as the assistant dean, and Blake was making speeches around the state and so forth. And
he was a man of reputation when he came here.
That's hard to say. I don't think he was well known, really. I don't. Tiger picked him, I think, but I don't know just why. But he was a very presentable person, and made a very nice appearance, and so on. But one of the first things that Blake ran into was the fact that Tiger was interested in setting up a general college, and he wanted all freshmen to take the same program, all sophomores to take the same program, and that caused a head-on clash between Blake Van Leer and Little and the president. And there was a lot of resentment on that account. When the war came, let me get my dates straightened here. That's right. So I don't know, Blake couldn't get the things that he wanted, and he felt that the engineering college would never amount to anything. He felt that he couldn't, that the administration would not support engineering, nor would the state. And that he'd go around the state, and he wanted to get an engineering industrial experiment station, and he would get resolutions from different groups recommending it and so forth. But the legislature couldn't get it to the legislature. And he would invariably go to Tigard and see if he couldn't get some money for research and engineering expansion, and he couldn't get it. And this irked him quite a bit. at that time WPA came into the picture. And the administrator, the WPA people were interested, but in order to get some work done, you had to get some university support besides the dean. And Blake didn't get it. And one of the things he had drawn up was a building for a hydraulic laboratory that he wanted to get out of PWA. And he could, and in order to get this building, this is before WPA, but to get this building, he had to get some money from the president to help get the thing going. And he couldn't get it. Well, it ended up that he decided to go to North Carolina. So he went to NC State. Now remember, one of the letters he wrote me was that how wonderful it was up there, how he liked to work and everything up there, what cooperation he's getting it there. And he was going to make that the biggest college in the South. So I wrote him back a letter, I remember very well. At that time I'd been appointed as dean. That I got his letter, and I'm glad that there still will never be any friction between the two of us, because as long as he's going to go out to make his the biggest and I'm going to have to make mine the best, he won't have any running.
They'll compliment each other.
Huh?
They would compliment yeah. each other.
Well, next
so thing. It was an accumulation of things that compelled him to leave the university.
Yes.
It was not just the general college.
No, it was the fact that he felt that, as he said, that he would, that this could never, without the support that he felt he was not getting from either the Tallahassee or the Board of Control or the President, this just didn't work out at all.
And he went from North Carolina State then to Georgia Tech as President.
No,
of the-
he went to the into the Army. But let's go back a little on this Van Leer business. After Van Leer, when Van Leer left, and I was dean, I had a budget of $67,000 a
this
year.
This is 1937.
Yes. So, and that had to cover everything. Well, I had made some friends with the governor. And
this was the this was your salary and expense budget, research, everything in the 67?
Anything was spent for the College of Engineering had to come out of $67,000. Now, I'd made some friends with the legislature, and especially with the pork shop gang, Beale and that crowd, and with the governor, and so forth.
And let's see, in 37, this would have still been Schultz, or was Fred Cohen?
It was Schultz first, and I didn't do so, and who preceded Holland, do you remember?
Well, you had Schultz, and then you had Fred Cohn, and then you had Millard
Caldwell.
Well, you had Holland, and then Caldwell.
Well, it was Schultz and Cohn that I made friends with.
Yes, and they were the ones in the 30s.
That's right, they're the ones that had, and the ones.
You see, you had Carlton from 28 to 32, then Schultz,
Carlton
and then
was a friend, too. So basically, when I became dean, I began thinking about this engineering sperm station again. So I went to my friends in the legislature. Well, let me go back a little more. But memory, you know, I have many notes, and so I've chosen clean my memory, but. Well, Blake was still the dean. I got a call from Schultz. That's where it started. He said, "This is the governor speaking." I said, "Yeah, well, this is the president of the United States you're talking to." I didn't think it was the governor, but it was. And so he said he has a problem. He'd like me to come to Tallahassee to see if I could work on it. And I said, "Well, could you tell me a little more so I could come prepared?" "Yes," he said, "I will." He said, "Up at Chattahoochee, they have a contract with the fire company, is sending them a contract. They wanted some electric power. and they're generating their own power. And they claim that they can save us money, and our people say that it cost them more. I'd like to get an impartial report. I said, all right, I'll come up. I went to see him. He said, how long will it take? I said, well, I'll go up there. It'll take me a week, I guess. I said, I have to run a test on their power plant. That takes time. So I went up to Tedahoochee and checked on their power plant. And what did I find? I found that they had an old rickety boiler with ancient equipment that they couldn't possibly make power for less than about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And the power company's making it about 2 cents. Well, they insisted. I said, well, look, it's simple to find out what it's costing you. Go to work and let's find out how many, over a period of several hours, let's put some, check the meters on the switchboard, and let's weigh the coal that we put in, how many wheelbarrows, we know how much coal's in a wheelbarrow, and we can soon find out how much it's costing just for coal. So they soon found out that it was costing them close to, coal alone, around 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So I said, well, that's the answer. I said, you can't do that. So I went back to Schultz and called him up and said, well, I'd like to make a report. He said, you're going to take a week. I said, well, I'm finished. I got it now. And so I went back the next day and I told him what the story was. And he said they wanted to buy some old pipe from sawmill or something that they would give him. I said, well, you know, if they get rid of the sawmill, it's not good enough to put in a stainless ocean. So then he put out an 8-inch equivalent of a second-hand pipe. Anyway, as a result, we got in worked out a good solution and everything, everybody was happy. And I had a good friend in Schultz. So then and then I met Beale through that too. So, and he was a powerhouse up in the, is his name familiar to you?
Yes, of course.
And he, of course, was very strong. He and I became very friendly.
Where was he from?
West Florida, somewhere.
What was his first name? I forgot.
Phil, wasn't it?
Phil, yeah. Now, you were getting ready to tell me a little bit about Blake Van Leer.
He'll come to me, right next.
Okay.
Now, when I came back, Van Leer said to me, he said, Joe, how about getting me to come before the legislature and make a talk on the experiment station? Now, I don't remember now whether Schultz was governor then anymore, or whether...
Cone. Fred Cone.
No. I don't know who was the governor anyway, but I was still, from then on, I worked every year almost with the legislature on some of their technical problems. See, so I got to know the legislature very well, and I would never take any money for any services that I gave to the state. I said, I'm a state employee and I owe that to the state, which was good politics too, as far as I was concerned. So basically, when Van Leer knew that I had some influence there, and so he asked to come up, I said, well, I can't do that, Blink. I said, but if you want to come up here, I'll talk to what was the name of the one of the legislators, and have him get to come before the committee. So sure enough, why he got an invitation to come before the committee, and I can still see him coming in for the committee and the chairman of the other end of the committee. He says, Mr. Dean, he said, we have just exactly 3 minutes for you to present your proposition. And you could see Van Leer's face getting red, you know. Well, anyway, he said, he gave him 3 minutes to present the engineered experiment station, and then there's a bunch of women from the, wanted to bring something up from the Everglades. He gave them 30 minutes right in back of Van Leer. And so Van Leer went back. Well, that killed the experiment station as far as Van Leer was concerned. 4 years later, or 2 years later, after Van Leer was gone, I again approached the legislature, and my friend said, don't bring it in now, it's too close to what happened 2 years ago. They said, but we'll let you know when we think it's right. So 2 years, so the next legislature, well, I got with them.
Legislature in those years met, at that time, met every other year.
Yeah. I said, 2 years later, well, they met, and I presented a bill, and it went through committees nicely, and then they asked the president what he thought about it and the Board of Control, and they said, well, if the legislature see fit, why, we won't oppose it or something like that. And so then anyway, why, the bill went through, I think, practically unanimously, possibly unanimously. In the meanwhile, I went, left Gainesville and was headed for Canada, the meeting up there. When I got up there, there was a whole sheaf of telegrams and things that about for my attention and so forth, because I thought everything was okay, and I just thought I'd disappear out of sight for a week. But the first thing I opened was, Governor Holland decides to let the bill go through. And so everything was all right. But what had happened was that the president, the Board of Control, had asked the governor to veto the bill, because they were afraid that if we got the $50,000 a year that was in that bill, that would be marked out against the university, and they didn't want to see it go that way. But apparently the Chamber of Commerce, State Chamber of Commerce, and some of the legislators influenced Holland not to veto it, and so the bill came along. And Bill Shan said it stuck in a clause in the bill that any monies that we got could not be mixed in with the university funds, that they had to be kept separately, and that any funds that we had would not revert at the end of each biennium. Mm-hmm. So we had the money. But Holland had made a stipulation that we would not spend any money until the governor's office said that there was money available that he felt it could be used for that purpose. So we got the engineering experiment station. And Blake, before he left, had set up a plans for the hydraulic lab, which he couldn't get through. But after he left, I had some friends with the WPA. And I told Tigard one day, I said, Tigard, I said, I'm having some of the WPA folks over the house for dinner on Wednesday night. If you can get away, I'd like you to be there at the dinner. I said, I think there'd be a good contact for you. He said, well, they won't do anything for us. I said, I don't know, maybe they would. He said, I'd like to see that hydraulic lab built. I said, well, you might approach him on it. So sure enough, I made a good dinner, and Tiger was there, and folks from Jackson were there. Sure enough, during the conversation after the dinner, Tiger would said to something to him about the laboratory. What the heck was it? Bob Dill, I guess is his name.
Bob who?
Dill, I think, was the name of the
Dill.
Administrator of the WPA. He told Tiger, he said, no, he said, that's not a WPA job. What was the other group?
WPA.
Well, one was WPA, and what was the other?
The PWA, Public Works Administration.
He said, that's a PWA job. And we can't touch it, it's not with WPA money. Oh, Tiger, he got disgusted, he got all his coat in the way when he went home. So next day I went over there and see Tiger, and Tiger said something about the fact that, well, we didn't have any luck. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said we couldn't do it. I said, yeah, that's what he told you. He said, but after you left, he said, do you want that job, Joe? I said, sure, I want it. I said, well, bring me the papers and I'll look them over. I said, I got them right here. You can sign. So he signed them, and that's where we got the hydraulic lab.
And
it's now 4 o'clock.
All right, we're continuing the interview this afternoon with Dean Weil here in the Ford Library, the Florida State Museum. This is Wednesday, May the 11th. All right, we're continuing. We were talking about the way you were able to secure funding from the federal government through under the auspices of the the PWA to put up the hydro, what?
WPA.
The WPA. And you were building what on the campus?
We built the hydraulic laboratory.
Where is it located?
That is the present Reed Hall. In other words, this was across from the stadium. And at that time, this was one of the most undeveloped parts of the campus. And there was practically nothing from there east until you got to the agricultural buildings. And when I picked that as a site for the hydraulic laboratory, and as I said, it would be the site, I hoped, of the future engineering buildings, a lot of people thought I was a little bit off in the rocker, I guess, because they said, now you're located in what is a center point of the campus, and now you're picking the part way out in the sticks of the campus. And I said, well, it's my belief that someday that will be the center of the campus. And I guess I had the lucky vision of being accurate in that particular aspect. Because later the engineering building, which is now known as Weill Hall, was placed there also, right in front of the stadium. And now a lot of people wonder, why is it that the engineers have gotten that choice location on the campus?
Tell me about the smokestack. I've always been curious about that large smokestack.
Well, I don't know whether I can tell you that on this record, because it might embarrass some people. We used to have a power plant located on the campus, and this power plant had a very large smokestack, which was peculiarly designed, that it came up to the top, and then it narrowed down, and where it narrowed down, there was some white cementitious material, ornamental, I suppose, at the very peak. But that was a beautiful soot catcher, and so it never stayed white for a very long period of time. And one day when Dr. Taggart and I were out walking in that part of the campus, he asked me, what could we do about that? And I looked at it and I said, well, I don't know, but if it was mine, I would... just a minute. I asked Dr. Taggart what he could do with it. I said, well, if it were mine, I would circumcise the gall darn thing. And I can still hear Dr. Taggart laughing for the next 15 minutes. At a later date, the entire unit, the power plant, was taken down because of the fact that it was only used for heating and it did not generate any electricity or anything of that nature.
So the smokestack, isn't it still there, or is it gone?
It's gone.
It was the largest, the highest structure on the campus for a long time, wasn't it?
I think so. I know so.
When did? How did you and Taggart get along? Were you good
well,
friends?
I thought Taggart was a very fine person, had very fine characteristics, and we did have quite a lot of contacts with one another on different things. I think my first contact with Dr. Taggart occurred not long after he came here. At that time, he was worried about the problem of the fact that the city wanted to charge us for our water. And so the city fathers came out here and told them that they were going to bill them for the water. So Dr. Taggart called me in to ask him what I thought about it. I said, well, the story is basically this. As near as I can tell, and I've looked into this before, the problem is that several years ago, back in 1904 or 5, certain people from the city of Gainesville went to see the Board of Control and made arrangements that if the university would be located at Gainesville, they would give them some land They would give them a little, some money, and they would also give them free water. Now that was back in 1905. In those days, they couldn't visualize the quantity of water that the university would use. So I found that there was no contractual agreement to that signature, but I indicated that the city, by its own volition, had over a period of years accepted this as a fact and had given the city the free water, and that was one of the considerations for moving the university to Gainesville. And on the basis of that, why we felt that there was legal justification for the continuation of free water. Furthermore, I contacted some of the people who were still living at that time, who were very influential and wealthy citizens in this town, and who had made this statement to the board in Lake City several years ago. So I let these people know that if by litigation the university was forced to pay for its water, the university might have to take legal action against these individuals to make up the deficit. Anyway, the result was that the matter was dropped and the university got free water. And that policy continued for a long time. But ever so often there would be a upshot of the water question and the amount of money it cost the city to furnish water to the city. It got so bad that several years later, the water pressure at the university was so low that you couldn't flush the toilets on the top floor of some of the dormitories. So we went to the city and told them our problem. They said, well, we're furnishing water, but there's nothing in there to say what pressure we have to furnish this water to you. So Dr. Taggart asked me, what should we do in the new case? So I said, well, I think what we ought to probably do is to dig a well and have a pump hooked onto it, and then have either a reservoir or a large tank or a water tower, and pump at night when the pressure is relatively good, pump water into the tower, and then during the daytime we would have that as a reserve for furnishing water to the campus. But I said that I did not want to do the engineering on that. I felt that was something for a city engineer, for a civil engineer to work out, and so I left it at that. In the meantime, I had to go out of town for some time, and the university hired an outside engineer, a very competent person. The interesting part about this is that when the that I indicated that the water that the water then would be available, and we would from the city. However, in the meantime, something else had occurred. Certain people who own properties northwest of the campus had built some subdivisions, and these subdivisions also required water. And since these people were rather politically strong in the city, they were able to have the city put in large water mains which passed the university and went to their holdings.
Like Garfield?
No, it was the other side. But basically the result was that we then had enough pressure that we did not have to put the pump. Well, I should also, going back a little bit, indicate that when I made the original proposition that we should have a pump and a reservoir and so forth, it meant that Dr. Taggart had to go to the Tallahassee and ask for $100,000 to put in this installation. Well, When the engineer who had been hired to determine what should be done about the water situation came, he recommended that the university build a pump house, install in it a pump and a well, and that this then would be a good emergency source, even though we did have water from the city. But that would only cost about $20,000. Now this gave the university a real problem, because we had $80,000 that was marked for this installation. And if we didn't use it, why, something almost unheard of